Good morning and welcome to the Friday, November 2nd meeting of the Washington Fish and Wildlife Commission. Ken's happy to be here in Vancouver. And we will go right into item number 7, which is open public input. And I was just told, I was just told and corrected constantly that we have a new beeper. So for those of you that know the beeper, this is a new beeper. And there's the beeper is malfunctioning. So
Sometimes.
You want to just do this? So, and I asked, what does that mean? That means sometimes it goes off after 1 minute. And what?
I'll let them know when the time is up if it messes up.
I know as much as you know about the beeper problem right now. So if you hear something weird, it's the beeper. But what that said, I'm going to call you up two at a time, and you've all been through this. You get 3 minutes until the weird beeper goes off, and then wind up your thoughts. So Joe Sagmiller and David Lynn, please.
For hearing my comments today, and I want to greet you all, and I appreciate you spending the time with us. When I originally came up here, I thought that this was a meeting to save the fish, but I didn't realize it was a regulation meeting. But I left some propaganda on your desk with a picture of a fish on one side and some hieroglyphics on the other. And these are my Christmas wish list. And I realize you can't pull it all off with the snap of the fingers. Or like I was telling the assistant today, place your hands upon the thing and say, heal all. But that's what I think it would take to bring the fish back to when it was when I was a kid. Because I was old enough to see June hogs. And they were impressed. They were as big as I was when I was 8. Give me an idea. And that's all I have to say. I think you guys are here for the right reasons. I think you all have a lot more education than I do. I've got some physical limitations. But they're mostly communication skills. So I hope I haven't offended you, but I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
You haven't done that, sir. Is that your son or father?
Which one? That's me.
Oh, I thought it said Tom.
No, it says Joe.
Oh, it does. Oh, well done, sir.
They're hieroglyphics, right?
Oh, the painting.
Oh, that's just the wife's artwork.
Oh, okay, yeah.
That's all.
Well done.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir. And JR, please. And David.
Good morning, Commissioners and Director Siswind. David Lynn from Ocean Shores, and here representing myself, but I express the thoughts and concerns of many of my friends and neighbors in Grays Harbor County. At your last meeting in Olympia, I spoke about certain issues regarding the Togo wolf pack depredations. As I examined the on-site incident reports of those depredations, it became clear that there were anomalies that called into question the justification for killing members of the Togo pack. Subsequently, I requested incident reports for all livestock depredations by carnivores from August 29th through September 17th of this year. On October 22nd, in response to my PDR, I received 22 reports. Of these, 7 were attributable to bears, 8 to cougars, 2 to wolves, and 5 unknown. The 2 wolf depredations were dated September 2 and September 7, with 1 casualty in each instance. However, the monthly wolf report for September 2018 on the Fish and Wildlife website lists several incidents. On September 5th, there were reported 3 depredations. September 7th, 2 separate depredations. September 11th and September 17th, 1 each. Surprisingly, the September 2nd incident does not appear on this list. The 3 depredations on September 5th were not documented on any incident report. Only 1 of the 2 depredations on September 7th was documented. The 1 depredation on each of the 11th and 17th were not documented. So over this period, the department claimed there were 7 wolf depredations upon cattle, but documented only 2 of them. There needs to be some accounting for these discrepancies. As I began to look into other reports, I found other discrepancies between the on-site incident reports and the website reports. One example is an August 8th investigation of a dead cow. The incident report states, quote, no bite marks or other blank injuries were present. Yet the August 20th report posted on the website says, quote, staff documented bite lacerations. Seems something has changed between these 2 dates, and I'm not sure what's going on, but I reiterate my concerns that the wolf killing protocol is badly flawed. I think the Wolf Advisory Group needs to more closely monitor the reported depredations and confirm their accuracy before any kill order is issued. As I wrote to Director Sussmund on September 17th, I understand that you issued a kill order on September 12th for one or more members of what is now called the Old Profanity Pack. They haven't even been around long enough to have their own name. Your decision was apparently based upon reports of six separate depredations between September 4th and 12th, and we've seen there were only two documented. Based upon what I have observed with the Togo Pack reports, I would be very skeptical of the accuracy of these reports, and I would like to review them before any lethal action occurs. I hope you realize that your predecessor ordered the elimination of the Profanity Peak Pack just 2 years ago, killing 7 of 11 known members, and the problems persist. Maybe it's the rancher, not the problem, not the bulls, because out of the 21, well, as of now, 21 wolf killings by the state, 17 were attributed to this one rancher. And I think that needs to be investigated. Thank you.
Thank you, David.
That is not the beeper.
And Bruce Barnes, please. And JR?
It's JR. I'm a Vancouver resident. I'd like to approach and show a photo that's on my phone. This was kind of a last-moment deal. I found out about this. And then I'm speaking on the trepanoma. This is a picture of a hoof off of a deer. It looks identical to what you have in your pamphlet here for elk.
That's the same one you had, Bruce?
Yeah. I gave it to you.
Okay.
Nobody's seen this before, but I've talked to 3 or 4 people and myself over 40 years of hunting, probably 200 years of different people hunting. Nobody's seen hoofs like that on a deer before. I'm hunting that up on Hancock property, and they spray those fields, and I think if these animals are eating what they're spraying for 3 or 4 years, then we're going to have a problem. That's all I want to say about that. I think we have a problem with the sprays. Other thing I'd like to talk about is your multi-season tags. I think they need to be eliminated. I know back in the 70s, I used to buy a deer tag, and I could hunt any season, as long as I used the weapon for that season. I asked at that time, why you guys quit that? Oh, it's too much pressure on the deer. It's too much pressure on the animals. Well, we even have more people now than we ever had back in the 70s. And now it's all right to put that pressure on there as long as you pay the money to do it. So I think that the multi-season tags need to go away. And another thing I think that needs to happen is you need to stop selling licenses after the season opens. I think that's just another way that you guys get money for animals that are killed illegal. Someone will go out there. They'll kill their deer, they'll kill their elk, they'll run down to Cougar, they'll run into Carson, they'll run someplace, buy their tag, go out and tag it. You guys profit on an illegal killed animal, and I think that's a shame. You guys told us back in the 70s, too much pressure. We need to stop this type of stuff. And now it's still all right as long as you get the money. Another thing I think needs to happen is up at that Klickitat River by the Indian fishing platforms, it's a mess. It looks like a garbage dump. It's a shame that we allow that to happen. We need to have some policing on that. We need to enforce some cleanup. And that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. And Ed Wickersham, please, and Bruce.
My name is Bruce Barnes. I live in Vancouver, Washington. Thanks for the opportunity to speak today. I'm here with concerns over, obviously, now finding deer in the Klickitat 578 unit, but my bigger concern is that I think we need to reduce the seasons. I was telling the vice chair here, I've probably ridden my bicycle 163 miles this year through 3 different seasons now, and I've seen nothing. I've seen a spike with a forked horn on the other side, deer. You're not seeing anything. You're not seeing a bull elk. I've talked to timber managers going, yeah, we wish we would have listened to you 10 years ago. We've got a huge problem with a lack of a resource, but we've got an even bigger problem with predators, right? And I hear this gentleman here, which I appreciate his comments, very, very good investigation, but we've got a wolf advisory committee. We've disbanded our hoof rot committee, which was not a citizens working group. There was one citizen on that group that wasn't from Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation, some sporting goods shop, the Fish and Wildlife. They didn't care what anybody had to say. You know what I mean? So going forward here, I don't know what the future of our hunting is going to look like, because our Fish and Wildlife said that the furthest east that this hoof rot was Trout Lake. But I know for a fact that there's about 100 elk in Biggs Junction, Oregon, which is across the Columbia River up above the Dalles, that all have hoof rot. So it's way further east than our Fish and Wildlife is telling people, right? So it's very ironic that the only thing in common is where these animals are living, because I hunt the National Forest and I hunt Pacific Corps property. You don't see any hoof rot on any of those properties. You know why? They don't spray. But everywhere that they do spray, if you lay a map over top of where these elk are affected, it's identical. And we just met with the new hoof rot scientist from Washington State University 3 Wednesdays ago at Mark Smith's house. She wanted to hear what our stories were and what elk hunting used to look like. I've also been working with the Discovery Channel about doing a show on what's going on here. So I took the gentleman up from the Discovery Channel to Mount St. Helens, only to be accosted by another huge mountain lion. I've seen 6 this year so far. And the reason that we're seeing this many cats and predators is because there's a lack of a resource for them to eat, right? They're competing against us, right? But yet we've got a wolf program, right, that doesn't give you guys any revenue like deer and elk do. But how many people are working on that program? I think there's, what, 9, maybe 10? We've got nobody working on the hoof rot. We've got one hoof rot coordinator specialist, Kyle. That's all we've got, right? So the revenue source that you get is not going to be a revenue source anymore if people start hunting other places. I mean, I think, what, was there 58,000 elk tags sold last year? Down from 365 5 years ago. My son is not even buying a elk tag this year. He says, what's the point, Dad? All we've seen in 2 different seasons, 4 legal bulls. I don't want to spend my $50. So you're not getting kids outdoors. You're not getting people to buy hunting licenses, and your product's broken. We need to fix it. I'm here to help. Tell me what I can do. I'm exhausted coming to these meetings. And my second question, real quickly, is why are we having this meeting here when we've got a multi-million dollar facility in Richfield that's got a facility this big that we can hold this meeting in, when you've got a $63 million shortfall? Is my question. Can anybody answer that?
Thank you, Bruce.
I guess not.
No, we're not here to respond to questions. We're here to listen.
Okay. Thank you for your time.
Yes, okay.
And I'm glad we've got somebody from the Department of Ecology now that's the new director.
I appreciate that, because now we can look into the petroleum-based chemicals that they're dumping all over our clear cuts. Because I know if I did that at my house, I'd be arrested. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director, going back about as many years as I've been on the commission, and Joe, you recall, back when Phil Anderson was director, maybe even before that, but might have been when Jeff Keenings was, this elk hoof rot issue came up, and it came up, and it came up, and we had stakeholders come in and public comment about it. We had the veterinarian, I don't recall the lady's name, and we had a list of universities involved in research, Colorado State, Wazoo, and others. I guess I'd like to suggest that we put together some type of review to bring us all up to speed on what has happened since this issue has become predominant in the management of elk in this state at a time that's appropriate. Sooner than later, please.
And Dr. Eileen Kaplan, please, and Ed.
Good morning. Mr. Chairman, members of the Commission, Mr. Director. I'm Ed Wickersham. I reside in Ridgefield, Washington. And I just wanted to talk a little bit this morning about gillnet bycatch. And I provided a little packet for you guys that you may see. And I want to offer a few facts on bycatch. I think it's a pretty complex issue. Harry Barber addressed these issues at the October meeting that I'm going to talk about and provided written documentation. But when I look at the PowerPoint slide that was provided in your briefing document, I come away thinking that's kind of inadequate and it maybe leaves the false impressions, but that's just me. I think I use the term, and I want to correct that, I use the term in the information I provided you that I view that there were serious omissions. Maybe I had too much coffee. I just think that that slide is leaving out the real essence of bycatch and gill nets. And I'll go on. They list sturgeon bycatch for recreational fisheries for years when retention was allowed, but fail to mention that there was almost no catch or bycatch in the 3 years when no recreational retention was allowed, 14, 15, and 16. However, for those three non-retention years, gillnet bycatch of sturgeon continued unabated in zones 4 and 5. And I think it's important to remember that just because you don't allow the retention of sturgeon in a commercial fishery, gillnets still handle the same amount of sturgeon. They just don't retain it. So if you're not in a directed recreational fishery, if you close sturgeon fishing, there won't be very many sturgeon handled because sturgeon fishing is done with certain kinds of gear. But with gillnets, what we see from the data we have is that if you put a gillnet in the river, you're going to catch sturgeon. Let me go on. For summer Chinook, staff indicated the recreational bycatch at 42%. I remind you that 42% includes all of the wild fish that were released since it was a marked selective fishery. For the summer Chinook commercial gillnet fishery, they list no bycatch. Again, I would remind you that the 2010 Observer study showed a bycatch of about 100%, including steelhead, sockeye, and sturgeon. The commercial gillnet fishery was non-selective, and they were allowed to keep and kill wild Chinook. So if, in fact, you treated it like the recreational fishery, then their bycatch wouldn't be 100%. It would have been like 150% because of those wild Chinook that the recreational fishery has to release, but they kept. I guess the point about bycatch is in the supporting documents to the briefing document, there's quite a bunch of studies on bycatch monitoring efforts. All kinds of figures. What you really see with bycatch is that it really becomes important to know what's in the river at a given time. If you look at run timing charts for the runs of salmon and steelhead in the Columbia River, am I there? With that, I guess I say thank you very much. Have a good day.
Is that... Can you maybe turn it up a bit? Thanks.
I think it's loud
for you guys.
I can hear it.
Okay. Well, thank you, Ed. Sorry you didn't hear that.
Thank you. Sorry.
Okay. Greg King, please, and Dr. Kaplan.
Thank you for the opportunity to speak. You can tell from my New York accent, I'm not originally from around here. I want to address some of the things that came up yesterday regarding the joint policies and the anticipated joint policies for the Columbia River fishery management policies. I do come with an appointment, a guest investigator appointment at the Woods Hole Oceanographic, and I'm a professor in upstate New York of environmental and marine policy, and my training is in sociology. I have a doctorate in sociology. My research has always been in the area, really, of co-management and the participation of stakeholders. And I want to commend the report that was reviewed yesterday as being overall very comprehensive, and I appreciated seeing the economic data as well as the public input. But I would like to suggest, as someone who's very concerned, spends a lot of time living in Portland, Oregon, that at this point, especially when you're looking at long-term goals, that you have primary data collection of the stakeholder groups, of the people, of the industry, of those who are using the resource, and to do it in a scientific way. I know that someone asked questions about chi-squares yesterday for the biological data or the gear data. There really isn't any hard data on, or at least I didn't see in the report, hard data on attitudes, use, policy, suggestions background of the people who participate along the Columbia River fishery. And I think as a social scientist, you really need to have that kind of hard data. It's serious data. It's data that can be collected. I know there are many researchers in Washington and Oregon university systems who are interested in these issues. And I think you should have not just input at public meetings, which is very important, but I think you have to go out into the field and talk to the people and have that be a part of the policy-making process. The policies will be much more effective. It'll be easier to reinforce if people feel they had serious input in the process. That's all I have to say.
Thank you.
Okay.
Yes.
Testimony and thoughtfulness on this. I wondered if you could give a couple of examples of social science data or categories to collect data in that you feel we ought to consider.
I would identify, do you want in terms of the Columbia River or prior research in the area of co-management?
Columbia River.
I would identify, well, first of all, I would go to the social scientists in the area who are doing research here, but I would identify the primary user groups. I would come up with a questionnaire that examines the different issues in all of the different policy areas that you're looking at. I would look at impacts. I would look at suggestions. I would look at their backgrounds, how they've used the resource before, how they are currently using it, what changes they've observed, if any changes at all, what their specific use of the resource is. Make them feel included. I think that needs to be done in a scientific way.
Thank you.
And Robert Suter and Greg.
Good morning, Commission. Good morning, Director Seeswin. Welcome aboard. I hope I pronounced your name right. I'm here to speak about Columbia River policy reform. I didn't get to come yesterday and listen to but I watched it on YouTube, and it was a great presentation by staff. It's a failure, guys. It's not working. It's not a Gilnet problem. It's a production problem. 160 million less smolt produced out of Columbia River hatcheries since 1992. It's a failed measure 81, which was 65-35 of the voters in Oregon to keep gillnets on the Columbia River. I just can't believe that we spent all this time working on this policy, and it's in the conclusion it says marginal. That tells me it's not working. It's not working at all. It's not working for sports, commercial, and tribal fisheries. Well, maybe somewhat on the tribal side, but I think it said 16% of the gillnetters are fishing in the safe area in Young's Bay. That's not very many for Washington. We produce smolt for the Cathlamet Channel out of our Calais River hatchery, and that isn't working. None of the safe areas are working in Washington. I would rather see them come back to our hatcheries and let the gillnetters fish one day a week like we used to in the old matrix. It worked pretty good. They fish Tuesdays, we fish the rest of the time. Not working on PHAS. The only thing that's working on PHAS is weirs. Okay. How are we gonna if we lose gill nets and PHAS numbers go through the roofs, we're gonna lose hatchery production. And sports, that's just shooting sports in the foot. You know. And I don't think sports really realize the ramifications of that. If commercial gill netting goes away, what are federal dollars gonna look? What's the Trump administration gonna do? You think they're going to pay for our hobby, sportsman's hobby? I don't think so. What will our tribes do? Will the tribes come and fish below Bonneville? And I hope they do. If the gillnets are gone, the non-treaty gillnets are gone, I hope they come down and fish and just show the sports just how good it's going to be. I'm not tribal bashing. I want you to know that. I'm not tribal bashing. My theme is all, we need to work together. Commercials, sports, tribes, both departments, to solve these problems we got and to produce some fish, because everybody wants fish swimming under their boat and in the fish box. And we just look at it. Where does the orca whale stand? We're having all these discussions on orca whale. They're starving to death because they're not producing enough fish. Thank you.
Thanks, Greg. Sean, are you? Oh, there you are, behind there. And Robert.
Just want to start that we did not recruit Mr. King for this testimony, so.
We're taking that for 3 minutes.
I've only met Mr. King once in the past, so don't look to me for where that testimony came from. What I want to talk about is the comments yesterday and that we've heard from the pound net people about the high quality of their fish and the marketing potential. As somebody who's marketed salmon for 35 years, I think that there's a lot of potential for good fish in the marketplace, but that the comments that the pound net provides something that I can't is a marginal claim. We've been handling fish carefully, icing on the boats, bleeding fish for a lot of years. When I get the fish, I take ice to the boats the day before the fishery. They bleed them on as they get them. They ice them for me. I buy them. I put them back in ice. As I'm cleaning them, I'm taking them out and cleaning them a few at a time and re-icing them. It's an extremely good product. And some of the markets say that they're the best fish they can buy anywhere on the coast. And they can buy from anywhere on the coast. So we're already doing a lot to create really high-quality fish in our industry. There's not a lot of, there are occasional niche markets for something, but it's not likely that there's a huge step available for that kind of marketing. It just isn't there. There's only so much gain available. Markets have other sources for their fish. There are very few of those prices no object kind of markets. Grocery stores and restaurants are low margin businesses. The market they might take on Chinook covers other lower value species. They almost always will challenge my price against other sources in the marketplace because they can buy other places. It takes a lot of time to market fish. I spend twice as much time buying, cleaning, and delivering fish as the fishermen do catching them. It's a whole other additional level, plus it requires year-round discussions with them to let them know what's going on. There's a lot of communication required. Some fishermen have co-ops now where they can improve the prices they receive, but that, once again, means they're doing extra work. Those relationships take time to develop. When I first started 35 years ago, I had a tough time getting people to buy fish directly from a fisherman. It wasn't common back then. It finally, after a couple of years, for six weeks I drove to Seattle every week to take a class at UW on marketing. And that's really what, on the third year, that got me started. And those are the same markets I have now. It's a totally different aspect than just the catching of the fish. We need a predictable, steady supply of salmon to make that kind of marketing work. And the Columbia River policy provides us with zero predictability. The only reason I can retain these markets when we have a fishery like this year of only 2 weeks is because they've known me for so long. And they know what I can bring, and they want those fish. And they have customers that wait to hear that Robert's coming up from Seattle, from the Columbia to Seattle with fresh salmon. Some fishermen have talked to me about altering their boats to make icing and other special handling easier, but they won't invest as long as this policy is in place. You can value add with frozen fish and sell online, but once again, you need a supply. You need to have enough that you can fill markets and that the quality is high enough that people will build on that with their friends. And you're not giving us that opportunity in this fishery with this policy. It's ridiculous where we are on this. And so I just want to say that we fish conservatively, we're easily managed, we market carefully now. There's not a huge range to build on that.
Thank you, Robert.
Any questions? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Question on marketing in a coho tangle net fishery in the fall. There has not been one for several years, as I understand it.
Right.
And you spoke of the difficulties of losing markets.
Right.
So if there was one next year or the year after, a long gap of no markets, would you still be able to sell commercially bought fish at a profit?
It would be a challenge for me because some markets forget that I used to have coho from late September till November, because it's been so long since we've been able to do that. I know that the bigger markets, though, like the bigger buyers, Steve Fick, who was here yesterday, he still has coho markets. But for me, it would be starting over again, really, because the market would take the fish. They'd still get a good price. For me personally, it would be difficult. There's a few of my markets ask every year, am I going to have some coho? Some of them, it would be harder, in all honesty. But overall, the market would take them. There's no doubt about that. There's no doubt that there would be a readily available market for Columbia River coho if you give us a chance to catch them. Me personally, it would be challenging to get started again. So, thank you.
Thank you, Robert. And Don Kinsley, please, and Sean.
Sean Cantrell, Defenders of Wildlife. At this point, wouldn't be surprised if y'all are thinking of that old country western song, How Can I Miss You If You Won't Ever Leave? I think in August, I was before you, or maybe it was September, and said goodbye. I'm transitioning out, and yet here I am again. But our new Northwest director was blessed with a brand new baby in September, so here I am. You're stuck with me at least until she comes back in December. I wanted to touch base just about grazing seasons and wolves. It's been a really hard year. Hard year for livestock producers, hard year for wolf advocates. There's just a lot of conflict, and it's straining the system, as you've heard, I'm sure, from the department staff and from livestock producers and from wolf advocates. My organization in particular was deeply disagreed with the department's decision on going to lethal removal on the old Profanity Peak territory wolves, and I don't want to rehash all that, but I do want to say that as much as we have very strongly disagreed with the department and the decision by the director, we remain fully committed to trying to work through and finding collaborative solutions. That's why, you know, the first week of October, I spent time up in Ferry County talking with elected officials up there and the impacted ranchers on Old Profanity as well as Togo. And this isn't just me. There was other conservation folks up there as well, trying to figure out how we can do something different, because we keep doing the same things, whether it be using the same particular non-lethal tools or using lethal removal, and we keep having the same problems. And with 3 years in a row with the same couple grazing allotment areas, it's been the same conflict. And you know, it's that old adage, you know, insanity is doing the same thing over and over and expecting different results. And that's what it feels like we're at. And I'm particularly worried of next year, will we be back in the exact same situation? So I don't have the perfect solution or a different thing exactly what we're going to do. But I think we need to do something different. And I do commend the department and the director of stepping up and saying, we're going to talk about this. And so whether it be with some of our more lively-tongued legislators or myself or other conservation groups, you know, the director has been willing to sit down and talk with us weekly, trying to figure out what we can do, what's on the ground right now, what can we do different. And so I think there's a real commitment from the department to try to do something different, but I just wanted you all to know that, A, you've got a great director, and, B, we've got a big problem still, and we're working collaboratively, we hope, to fix this. I know I'm probably not the most popular person up in Northeast Washington these days after putting out statements a couple times saying that we thought this was the wrong decision, but I just want to implore you all to continue to support finding the positive solution forward. We all put in a lot of work and time and would hate to see it all kind of just get frittered away.
Thank you. You're always welcome back. And Larry Carey, please. And Don.
Yeah, good morning. Thanks for allowing me to be here again. You know, just sitting here, one of the gentlemen back here, he's a commercial guy. I agree with him 100%. Our problem is lack of fish. And for years, you know, we've met with the department and tried to convince him to use part of our hatchery fish as part of the recovery that we need. Because wild fish thing is working, it's pretty obvious. But they come out with an article the other day, and I don't know if you guys are aware of it, but it's from Chelan County PUD. They did an off-channel, and I'll just kind of hit on a couple points on it. They constructed an off-channel. The feds wanted them to, under the wild salmon thing. But at any rate, they raise their own salmon. Okay, it says even the fish were raised by the PUD biologists in a hatchery, and they were descendants of hatchery fish. And as you go down, as they got these fish in the side channel, by 2009, so probably about 10 years later, the hatchery fish responded naturally, and they had doubled in numbers. So basically, because they started with about 185 spawning fish and now returning on their own under spawning, they've got over 421. So I just kind of wanted to kind of throw that, and maybe I can leave one of these with you, because I believe that we can use our hatchery fish as part of the recovery. Them dudes go out there and they come back. And if we can get enough of them in the gravel, and I know that it happens because we call them naturals and whatever names we call them. But if they keep coming back, and even though it might take a while, we'll get families of fish back in the gravel. And one other thing, I don't know, it seems like all the meetings that we go to, nobody from the feds are here. And, it'd kind of be nice to chew on their ass a little bit. Because I think the policy is a total failure. And I believe there's probably quite a few people in this room believe that direction is, we're going to collapse if we don't turn it around. Is there anything you guys can do or give me a direction to where we can try to get somebody from the feds in front of us where we can testify to them?
We'll mull that one over.
Oh, okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We share some of your frustrations in that court, too. So, and Larry, you're the last one on this for this agenda item.
Well, thank you. I want to say thanks to the directors, to the chairs, and all the commission for having me. It's a nice thing that we can do this. I'll read you something here. It has a lot to do with what Don said. Look into all salmon being equal. Our science has failed on wild fish. To see it right, a mix of genetics blending over time cannot be controlled. Our federal science has refused to be adaptive and become rigid, leading us with genetically polluted fish. But they play God and have a huge congregation of followers saying these are pure wild fish. Purely mudfish are already sustaining uncontrollable reproduction in our rivers. Mentally, we are no match to what is physically happening, will continue forever. Salmon need us to demand the fools to listen up. Selectively use hatchery fish to reestablish historical spawning numbers back to our rivers. That's what we need. We need spawning fish. Where done is very effective. We have options. We want them spawning. We would achieve quickly more natural fish living as nature intended to join what is already genetically mixed natural fish. We should be selective, using, not wasting, and killing successful adults because mental science has dictated them inferior. Our leadership must turn to these fish and realize they are the majority of river fish spawning, already firmly entrenched. We indiscriminately harvested wild fish, populations so low they had no choice but to spawn with hatchery fish. Unharvested, off-channel site fish are now spawning out there, somewhere. That's not all bad. The mudfish is dominating rivers naturally, and we should stop fighting against them. Our leadership has picked the questionable wild fish that is only wasting time and money and losing with each generation of fish blending predictably. Our recovery projects will only prolong the wishy-fishy idea. Ever notice they dig to plant shrubs, but no fish are planted? No accounting is done on success or not. After our money, time, and effort, there is fewer fish. Counting how many funded projects get the ink, but counting losses of fish doesn't. We have placed salmon above their ability, bringing extinctions alarmingly faster and closer than ever. Shameful, wrongful, disgusting, deceitful, dreadful, pathetic explains why our salmon, by our federal policy, was incorrectly identified down to too few for recovery, since NOAA or NIMS have led this disaster void of common sense.
Thank you. So,
thank you.
Thank you all. That was very beneficial for all.